Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm going to be speaking today with Dutch historian Rutger Bregman on the challenging and hopeful ideas in his book Humankind, which asks whether humans are naturally or originally bad or good, selfish or social. And to learn more, you can go to rutgerbregman.com. That's RutgerBregman, all one word, rutgerbregman.com. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net. TerrenceMcNally.net. Today's guest, Rutger Bregman, has made a name for himself by speaking truth to power. A couple of videos of him in action have gone viral on the internet. One was when he challenged his hosts at the World Economic Forum to speak not just about their ambitious philanthropy, but about their at least equally ambitious efforts to avoid paying taxes. The other was a recording of a conversation between Bregman and Fox News host Tucker Carlson that never actually made it to broadcast. But in it, he chastises Carlson, who he addresses as a, quote, millionaire working for billionaires, who likewise avoids the issue of wealth of the wealthy and their taxes whenever possible. But we're not here to talk about those today. Rather, we're going to focus on questions very close to Rutger Bregman's heart. Can we dare to think that people are kind? And how would we shape society if we did so? That human beings are by nature selfish and governed primarily by self-interest is dogma, accepted by Western psychologists, philosophers, writers, historians, politicians. It drives our headlines as well as our laws. But what if it's not true? Bregman's done the research and he declares, quote, civilization has become synonymous with peace and progress and wilderness with war and decline, but in reality, for most of human existence, it was the other way around. And he believes that this new understanding matters. Quote, if we had the courage to take this more seriously, it's an idea that might just start a revolution. Once you grasp what it really means, you'll never look at the world the same again. Rutger Bregman is, as I said, a historian and author. His books, Utopia for Realists and Humankind, are both New York Times bestsellers. They've both been translated into more than 40 languages, and he's twice been nominated for the European Press Prize for his work at The Correspondent. Welcome, Rutger Bregman, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Thanks, Terrence. Great to be with you.
And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, July 6th. First of all, I'd like to ask my guests, how are you and how have you coped with the pandemic?
Well, I'm good. I really can't complain. You know, us writers, we weren't really the people who suffered a lot, you know, from this period of social isolation. You know, the book Humankind was published in English last year around the beginning of the pandemic. So obviously I was supposed to go on a book tour in the UK and in the US, and now everything was remote. And you know, I rather liked it. I must be honest.
I mentioned that you were nominated for the European Press Award for your work in The Correspondent, and I looked up some of your work in The Correspondent, and the last thing I saw was that The Correspondent was no longer in existence. Tell me, am I wrong? What is or was The Correspondent?
Well, it still exists in the Netherlands. So in the Netherlands, where I live, it's a really successful publication, and we try to expand it into English, but that turned out to be rather difficult, especially since we started at the beginning of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So that was a really bad timing, obviously. No, but that experiment just failed. But The Correspondent in the Netherlands is really thriving. And to be honest, it's basically my laboratory. It's mm-hmm. the way I work as a writer. So what I do is I write essays, say one essay a month, and I publish them in Dutch. And I get a huge amount of feedback from readers at The Correspondent, and I learn a lot from that. And then, that's sort of the way I wrote Humankind as well. It was almost like a collaborative process, right? I've always found it weird that writers, they go offline for a year or years even.
Yeah.
You know, they go into some kind of cave or something like that. And they just think and do research, and then they write and write and write. And then they publish it and they hope for the best, right? Which sort of seems like a risky way of doing the work. I think it's much more sensible to get feedback while you're doing it, and not just from your editor, you know, and the people who around you who sometimes, you know, find it hard to deliver the really harsh criticism or the important criticism. So this really, really worked for me. Actually, the most important chapter in the book, and maybe the most important thing I've ever written, I couldn't have written it without my readers. So the second chapter of the book is about a story that took place in 1965 near Tonga, which is an island group in the Pacific Ocean. It's basically a real-life Lord of the Flies story about six kids who shipwrecked on an island and survived for 15 months by working together and by staying friends. It's really an extraordinary tale. And when I published it in The Guardian, they published an excerpt. You know, it really went viral, and now there's going to be a Hollywood movie, et cetera, et cetera. But I would never have written this story without my Dutch readers, because what happened is that at first I wrote an essay in which I compared Lord of the Flies, you know, the original novel from William Golding, that's a much more pessimistic story about kids who shipwreck on an island and who turn into savages, you know, and become really violent. And at the end of the novel, they're only... three of the kids are dead.
Yep.
It's a really dark tale. And I compared it to a scientific experiment that took place around the same time. It's called the Robert's Cave experiment. Anyway, long story. I published the essay and people just didn't find it convincing. You know, there was a lot of replies and comments that said, look, Rutger, this is really not... If you really want to make the case that kids will behave in a different way when they, you know, end up on a remote island, you know, you got to talk about what really would happen in such a case, right? You got to look at maybe a natural experiment. Maybe this happened sometime, you know, in old world history. Or maybe there are some parents somewhere who are willing to drop their kids on an island just for science, right? And to see what happens. So my readers really pushed me to do my homework, basically, and to do more research.
Yeah.
And without them, I probably wouldn't have done it, I think.
And the real life story, which you found and which you wrote about and which has now become a phenomenon, you were unaware of it. And I'm pretty certain I was unaware of it. I have a feeling I learned about it from you indirectly, which is in its own way remarkable, given what a remarkable story it is, that it had faded. And I thought you were going to say one of your readers pointed you toward it, but they just told you, go look and see if you can find some.
Yeah. That's how it happened. So, it was really some readers. And this is, by the way, also important to say is some people will say, well, have you ever watched or read the comment sections, you know, at news websites?
Yeah.
You don't learn a lot from them. But what we do at The Correspondent is we say only members can post comments. You have to include your full name. You have to include your own expertise, right? What you do in your daily life. Are you a plumber? Are you a professor? Mm-hmm. Are you, I don't know, an activist? Everyone, you know, has his or her own expertise. And we ask people for what they know, you know, not what their opinion is or what they think or something like that, but what can you contribute? So we also call it like contributions. So this is like small psychological nudges that I'm not saying they always work, but in general, you know, our comment section is really, really good. Actually, there's a lot of knowledge that you can find there as a writer. In this case, my readers sort of really pushed me to go on this journey. And well, for me, it basically started on Google. You know, I was just Googling like real life Lord of the Flies and kids on an island, did it ever happen? And at first I stumbled upon some obscure blog that told this story that supposedly this had happened in 1977, that six kids had shipwrecked on an island near Tonga. It didn't seem very trustworthy. So again, you know, I posted it on the correspondence website, and many readers said, you know, this seems like, I don't know, some kind of urban myth, something that didn't really happen, right? It's because it's the same story with the exact same words everywhere that you find on the internet.
Oh, yeah.
It probably didn't happen. But I was a little bit stubborn, so I started looking in Australian newspaper archives and spent hours and hours just looking for this story, because if it had really happened, obviously there should be something about it in a local Australian newspaper, right? And then by pure accident, I was looking in the 1960s instead of the 1970s, right? Because I thought it would happen in 1977. But then I was looking in the 1960s, which just, you know, I clicked in the wrong way with my computer.
Basically
and
a
typo. Suddenly, yeah, exactly, yeah. And then I saw it, you know, on my screen, 1966, six Tongan castaways have been found, you know, on this island. And then I realized, okay, this really happened. I had the names. I had the name of the captain who rescued them back then. And then I started calculating and I realized, hey, maybe these people are still alive.
Oh, yes.
Right? So the captain should be around 90 years old. The kids who back then were 13 to 14, 15 years old should be around 70 years old. Maybe I can find them. So that's what I did. It took a long time, but I managed to track them down and interview some of them in Australia. And they told me this extraordinary story that if it would be a novel, no one or people wouldn't really like it, I'd say. They said they were like, oh, this is just this sentimental Hollywood tale, right? Kids would never behave like that. But it really happened. These six kids survived for 15 months by staying friends. It's a story of resilience, adaptation, and especially, you know, staying true to one another and trust. And I felt it was really a story that people needed to hear, maybe especially today.
Yes, and I'm getting that it is no mistake that it shows up as chapter two, because it is such a wonderful jumping off point for the rest of the book. But you were already in the process of pursuing this question; you just hadn't found this wonderful example.
Yeah. So, Humankind, the book is about a new view of human nature. Or maybe it's an old view of human nature that has often been dismissed as ridiculous or romantic or naive or whatever. And I'm trying to make the case for it. The reason I wanted to write the book is that in the last couple of decades, there's been a silent revolution in science. A lot of scientists from many different disciplines, anthropologists, psychologists, sociologists, archaeologists, you name it, have been moving from a quite cynical view of human nature, of who we are as a species, to a much more hopeful view. And all of these scientists, you know, many of them brilliant experts, they really focus on a small part of the puzzle, right? That they're very, very specialized. It's one of the problems maybe in academia today. Obviously, this specialization generates a lot of great knowledge. But the problem is, I guess, is that sometimes these experts don't realize what's going on in a field next to theirs.
Yes.
And so what I wanted to do in this book is to connect the dots and to show that something bigger is going on. That this is maybe like, it's something of a movement, or as I said, a silent revolution in science.
Well, it's interesting, actually, that you would say a movement, because to some extent, for it to be a movement, they'd have to know about each other and be moving together.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah.
So it's
yeah. So
well,
maybe movement
well,
is not the
invisible
right
hand at work, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So let me ask you: was there a moment when you knew you had to pursue this question? A moment when you knew you had to write this book?
There was. Last time we spoke was about my previous book, Utopia for Realists. And one of the main ideas in that book is the idea of giving everyone a basic income, a guaranteed basic income. Now, when we spoke, I think that was in 2017?
Yes.
It was still a quite obscure idea.
That's right.
Right. There were some people talking about it on blogs and some articles, and there were a few books out there. But I think most people hadn't heard yet of someone like Andrew Yang, you know, who had a hugely successful campaign out of nowhere. a presidential campaign. And he obviously, you know, made a lot of people acquainted with this notion that you can just give people free money and it might actually be a good idea. But so in that book, Utopia for Realists, I really tried to make the case that it isn't nuts. It actually works. And it can actually save money in the long run as well. Because if you pull people out of poverty, crime rates go down, kids do better in school, and etc. You know, you also have to spend less on healthcare, for example, because obviously poverty means that people just become less healthy, etc. So the way I tried to make the point in that book was to quote a lot of scientific studies, right? And to say, look at the evidence, people. Mm-hmm, this mm-hmm. really works. And that didn't really work. So what my experience was while I was on a book tour is that people find these experiments quite interesting in the studies. But what happened to me again and again and again while I was on a book tour is that always after 20 or 30 minutes, someone would say, yeah, this sounds all very interesting and maybe it happened or maybe it worked in Canada in the 1970s, right, you know, right. with this crazy local experiment. Maybe it works in crazy Europe where everyone is like these dangerous socialists or whatever. But surely you can't scale this up because human nature. Mm-hmm. People deep down are just lazy. People deep down are just selfish. Just giving them free money goes against human nature. So it's never going to work on a bigger scale. That happened to me again and again. I ended up in philosophical arguments about human nature. And then at some point, I think it was in 2018 or something like that. I don't know. I was talking to a friend of mine who's an anthropologist, and he had just written a book about democracy. And in the book, he makes the radical case that we should completely rethink what democracy is. So we very much associate democracy with elections, right? Mm-hmm. That we have the power to choose our own aristocrats. But is that really democracy, right? Isn't it just an elective aristocracy, right? Mm-hmm. There are still aristocrats at the top, but it's not the people who really rule. So he makes the case that we should move to what we call a deliberative democracy, where it's actually the citizens who are in power. Now, there are a couple of ways to do this. You can do it with what they call participatory budgeting, mm-hmm. where you just allow a lot of people to have a say in, you know, how a city, for example, is going to spend its money. Or you can do a sortition, you know, randomly select people from the population and say, okay, you're going to be the politicians, just like a jury, right? Just like jury service. But you can do that for, you know, other domains in politics as well. That's the idea. Now, I was talking about this book, which is a great book, by the way. It's his name is David Van Rybrook, and the book is called Against Elections. We were discussing, you know, just the experience of promoting our books, and he said that he had experienced the same phenomenon, right? That people were very interested in all these experiments that were done around the globe, where it turned out that this actually works if you bring people together, you know, from the left to the right, rich, poor, young, old. You put them around a table and let them discuss really controversial subjects and issues. They come up with perfectly sensible compromises, right? And they're really capable of having quite rigorous and complex discussions about these difficult issues. It's just what you assume in other people is what you get out of them. If you assume that most people are these lazy mm-hmm. idiots who just want to scream at Twitter or watch Netflix all day, well, that's what you're going to get. Now, so he also said to me that his experience was that people were, again, interested in the experiments, but every single time the real discussion was about human nature. You know, people said to him, look, deliberative democracy sounds interesting and maybe it works, you know, in this particular experiment, in this small place, whatever, or in the 1970s, but surely you can't scale this up because human nature. And that's when I thought, huh, maybe someone's got to write a book about human nature, because so many of the ideas that I was excited about and still am excited about, universal basic income, reforming the criminal justice system, participatory democracy, etc., etc., they all seem to rely on a more hopeful, a more optimistic That's view right. of who we are as a species. But no one, or almost no one, was really making that case. It was just mainly specialists, you know, from their different disciplines, yeah. Psychologists and anthropologists. I saw the pieces of the puzzle were there, but someone just needed to connect the dots. And that's what I try to do in my book.
Yeah. One book that you cite early on that I interviewed the author about and cite mm-hmm. repeatedly is mm-hmm. Rebecca Solnit's book.
Mm-hmm. Built in Hell.
Built in Hell, in which she yeah. points out that unlike the mythology and the media presented, quote, reality of people in the face of natural disasters. Katrina's the first one that caught her eye, but then she went back and checked the earthquake of 1906 in San Francisco mm-hmm. and so on and so on, and found that, in fact, people do not degenerate in the face of natural disasters. They come together, they help each other, and so on. And yeah, I mean, that's just one book that, you know, had sort of shined a light out there. But yours really says, let's talk about the question. Let's talk about, and the way I phrase it sort of is whether humans are naturally or originally good or bad, social mm-hmm. or selfish. Is that pretty accurate as describing what the question is you're pursuing?
I think so. So I think it's important to say that being good is not the same thing as being nice, right? So sometimes actually friendliness or niceness, is that a word?
Yeah.
is the problem, right? And stands in the way of justice. One of the big paradoxes of my book is that progress very often starts with people who are willing to go against the group, who are willing to be a pain in the ass, right?
Mm-hmm.
And who are not necessarily all that friendly all the mm-hmm. time. That is sort of the paradox. So what I do really try to show in the book is that we have evolved to be friendly and to work together, and that this is our secret superpower as a species. Or to put it differently, if you ask the question, what makes human beings special? Why have we conquered the globe?
Yes.
Why not the Neanderthals or the bonobos or chimpanzees or whatever? Why us? Well, for a long time, we like to believe that it's because we're so intelligent, right? We're super smart. We have these huge brains that use 20% of our energy, right? And that was the answer we always liked to hear. But I think that's... It has become quite hard to believe that, because modern scientific evidence suggests, and I think scientists have convincingly shown, that actually animals are much smarter than we used to believe. And for example, if you do an intelligence test and you let a human toddler compete against a pig or against an ape or a chimpanzee, for example, quite often the animals win. You know, humans, especially in early age, seem to be quite dumb. It's only when they become older and when they learn a lot of things from other humans that they become smarter. But many of those things, you know, that we find very special, for example, I can count to 10, which is, I know, it's quite amazing. but I probably wouldn't have been able to come up with a numerical system on my own, right? So we pretty much learn everything from other people. And that is our secret superpower.
Yes.
So psychologists call that social learning. And it turns out to be pretty much the only thing that we really excel at compared to chimpanzees and bonobos. It's our secret superpower. But that only works, obviously, if we actually communicate with one another and if we live in relatively large societies where you meet a lot of new people who have new ideas, et cetera, et cetera. And so that is the really fascinating argument that evolutionary anthropologists are making right now. That, for example, compared to the Neanderthals, they probably were smarter on an individual level. You know, they had bigger brains.
They had bigger brains, exactly.
Yeah.
That brow had something behind it.
Yeah, exactly. So I make a little bit of a simplistic comparison, but maybe that's helpful. In the book, I say, well, the Neanderthals are a little bit like MacBook Pros, right? And we're MacBook Airs. The difference is that we have Wi-Fi, so we're interconnected and we learn from each other. And that's what makes the difference in the long run.
Let me just tell people a little bit about the way you write, especially in this book, which is that there is a big narrative. And the big narrative is your search for, you know, your pursuit of this question of human nature. And that may take you to history. It may take you to science, etc. But within, in your pursuit, you then tell stories, exemplary stories. And it's, I find it a, you know, a wonderful way to learn that mm-hmm. what you're learning in pursuit of your question, you're delivering to us usually in story form. And some of the stories, you know, really grabbed me. Briefly, the story about the foxes.
Mm-hmm. So one of the most interesting new theories from biology and evolutionary anthropology is a theory that was already developed in the 1950s, but that now, you know, a lot of new interesting work is being done on it. And it's called the theory of self-domestication. Now, I think we all know what domestication is, right? You've got pigs and cows and sheep, and these are domesticated animals, which means that for centuries, humans selected the more tame animals, like and the friendlier animals. And in that way, well, you can start off with a wolf and you end up with a chihuahua, right? That's what we call domestication. Now, Charles Darwin already noted in the 19th century that it seems to be the case that domesticated animals have certain traits in common. He called this domestication syndrome. So what do you have to think about? Think about thinner bones, smaller brains, white spots in the fur. And these animals are often more playful, domesticated animals. And maybe most importantly, it seems to be the case that they never really grow up, right? It's that they're always a little bit juvenile compared to their wild ancestors. So that's domestication syndrome. With modern genetic research, we also sort of know what genes play a role here. And here's where it gets really interesting. If you look at humans, it seems to be the case that we are also domesticated. So compared to our ancestors, to, you know, hominids 50,000 years ago or Homo sapiens 50,000 years ago, we have smaller brains, we have thinner bones. And it also seems to be the case that we are incredibly playful, right? We are a really playful creature, and we're also really slow in growing up, right?
Yes.
I think officially it takes 18 years, but for most people that's not, right. At least for me, it wasn't enough. But we're, again, compared to wild animals, it takes a lot of time, and we just gotta learn a lot before we're really adults. So it seems to be that we have been domesticated. But then the question is obviously, who did it? Who domesticated us? And the answer is, we did it to ourselves. So in our history, there was a process going on that scientists call survival of the friendliest, which literally means that for millennia, it was actually the friendliest among us who had the most kids and who had the biggest chance of passing on their genes to the next generation. Now, how do we know this? One of the most interesting pieces of evidence is this experiment that was done by Dmitry Belyev with silver foxes. So here the silver foxes come in. It was in the 1950s. It was a very hard environment, by the way, to do research. Back then, it was illegal to study genetics in the Soviet Union.
Oh, right.
They saw evolutionary Darwinist theory as a form of fascism or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they would have you killed if they knew you were doing it. Actually, Dmitry's brother was also a famous geneticist, and he was killed by the regime. So what Dmitry was doing was he was doing this amazing experiment in secret with silver foxes, very much in the east of Russia, in Siberia. And he and his co-researcher, Lyudmila Trut, if I pronounced that correctly, probably not. What they did is they had the ambition to domesticate an animal. You got to know that silver foxes had never been domesticated before. These were really wild, ferocious animals, you know, quite aggressive, quite violent. But their idea was that they would select sort of the foxes who were the least aggressive, you know, who were a little bit slow in with biting, etc. And they would do that generation after generation after generation, every single time, sort of pick the 2-3% who are the least aggressive and let them have kids again and again. And when it started, you gotta realize just how ambitious this was, because domestication took centuries or millennia in history, right? Mm-hmm, in our evolutionary mm-hmm. history. So I don't know what he was thinking, but it could have, taken centuries. But I don't know, maybe it's a Russian way of thinking. But he started it. And interestingly enough, already like after 5 or 10 generations of foxes, you could really start to see striking, striking differences, that indeed these foxes were becoming much friendlier, much more playful, thinner bones, smaller brains, white spots in the fur, etc. All the sort of the traits that we already knew should be there of domestication syndrome, they originated in these foxes. But now it gets even more interesting. There's a researcher called Brian Hare who's just published a fascinating book that is called Survival of the Friendliest, by the way. I can recommend it to everyone. And what he did, I think almost 50 years after Dmitry Belyev started his experiment, he went to Russia, to Siberia, to study these foxes. And he started to perform intelligence tests, both on the wild foxes, who had not been domesticated, and on the domesticated foxes. And it turned out that the domesticated foxes perform much better on these intelligence tests, especially the tests where their social intelligence was being measured. You know, their ability to learn from each other and to understand what humans were communicating to them. So what Brian Hare concluded is that if you want to have a smart fox, you don't select for intelligence. No, you select for friendliness. And what he argues is that this is exactly what happened in our own evolutionary history as well. So we became smart by this selection for friendliness, right? Because we became more friendly, more willing to learn from each other. We started to build something that was transcending us, like a collective brain, collective knowledge. If you think about it, if you think what wealth is today, it's this thing that is not really produced by individuals, right? Almost everything we use, I'm sitting in a room here with a lamp, with a microphone in front of me, with a computer, there's a camera here. I understand nothing of all of it. Mm-hmm. I am completely incompetent. I wouldn't be able to prepare my own food. Modern humans are incredibly incompetent, and still we're richer than ever, because we cooperate on a skill that no other animal in the whole animal kingdom has ever done. And we can only do this because of this process of survival of the friendliest, because we've become so good at learning from each other and basically built this cumulative culture. Anyway, it's a very long story, but it's one of the most exciting new ideas, I think, out there in evolutionary anthropology. And a lot of work is being done on it right now.
It's
one of the stories I tell in the book.
Yeah, no, and it just captivated me. And I feel like for people to get an idea of how far afield in a way you might go to examine this question and build this case, So let me tell people, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terence McNally. I'm speaking with Rutger Bregman on the challenging ideas in his book, but the exciting ideas and the forward-looking ideas in his book, Humankind, A Hopeful History, which asks the question whether humans are naturally or originally good or bad. What is human nature? Is it selfish? Is it social? Do we treat each other well? Do we cheat each other? What's our root? Where do we begin, and so on? And you can learn more by going to rutgerbregman.com. That's RutgerBregman, rutgerbregman.com. How revolutionary... You've spent a lot of time in this trench here. How revolutionary mm-hmm. Do you believe the expansion of this as an accepted worldview would be? How much of a paradigm shift is this? And what sort of can you envision?
I think it's quite revolutionary, Terence. Some people may think, oh, this guy has written this nice, warm book about human kindness or whatever, you know, something like this innocent self-help book that won't change anything.
Good for him.
I really beg to differ, because everything or so much depends on your view of human nature. What we assume in other people is what we get out of them. And for centuries, maybe even for millennia, cynicism has been the ruling ideology of those in power. Mm-hmm. If we cannot trust each other, then we need them. Then we need the kings and the queens. We need CEOs and managers. We need a powerful army. We need police forces in the street, etc. Because otherwise there would be mayhem. You know, people would start looting and plundering and killing each other, etc., etc. And we need hierarchy. We need inequality, if that would be true. Now, if I'm right, and if it's actually the case that deep down most people are pretty decent and we are wired for connection and working together, well, then maybe we don't need all these kings and queens and managers and CEOs, right? And we can move to a much more democratic and genuinely egalitarian society. So a lot is at stake here. It's really one of the most fundamental questions you can ask. And once you update your view of human nature, it has massive implications for how you organize your whole society, from your prisons to your schools, from the workplace to the way you do democracy. Everything changes.
And do you think that change? I'm thinking about how we change our views of things, how you'll see a society change your view of things. And it seems to me it might be easier if it's your view of transportation, or if it's your view of even energy. But if it's your view of yourself, who we are, who what we are, is that a bigger challenge, or is that one that may suddenly hit a critical mass and shift in a big way? What do you have a guesstimate on that?
It's a good question. So in a way, I'm trying to remind people of what they already know. So if you ask people about themselves or about their friends or family members or coworkers or the people who live in their street, they'll say, oh, these people are quite nice. You know, they're good. You know, they're some, you know, bad apples.
Bad apples.
Of course. But most people here are quite decent. It's just that those other people far away, you know, that I hear about on the news or that I read about in the books or that I see in the movies, you know, those other people, they're not good. They're bad. Most people deep down are just selfish. So what I try to do in the book is also ask the question, if it is true that most people deep down are quite decent, then why do we so often believe the opposite, right? Where does that come from? Now, I already mentioned that it's very often in the interest of those at the top, you know, to spread this ideology of cynicism. But it's also in the sort of the information that we consume on a daily basis. The simplest example is this thing that we call the news, right? When I was young, my parents told me that I have to follow the news because then I'll be an informed citizen, right? And it's the right thing to do. It took me years, and I actually had to become a journalist before I realized that is actually not the case. And that the news itself, even sort of the what we call the objective news, is problematic in so many ways, because the news, by definition, pretty much always focuses on the negative, on the pessimistic, on the things that go wrong, on corruption, crises, violence, etc., etc. So many journalists seem to start the day with the question, what is the worst thing that happened today? Because everyone's got to know about it. And so if you consume that kind of information on a daily basis, and we know that around 90% of people in the developed world consume the news on a daily basis, what is it going to do to you, to your view of human nature, to your brain, to your mental sanity? It's really not good for you. Psychologists have long known about this phenomenon called mean world syndrome that especially seems to be prevalent among people who are addicted to the news. And these people, they just believe that the world is a very nasty and bad place. And it's understandable, because if you watch CNN all day, or if you watch Fox News all day, or even MSNBC, you know, it's very easy to get the impression that most people are just really selfish or worse, right? If you're on Twitter all day, it's not going to be good for your view of human nature. Right. So This problem is deeply embedded in the kind of information that we consume on a daily basis.
So yeah, and this was the question of that this is the challenge we face in changing this. And I want to take this on just a little bit more. I was talking about this on my week. I have a weekly Zoom call with my SIBs. It started during the pandemic. It's one of the great things of the pandemic. I have five brothers and sisters. And I was on the call this past Sunday with four of them. I started talking about this book and that I was going to be talking with you. And I made the, you know, put out the premise. And one of my sisters who is, I mean, exemplary, passionately, actively committed to the good in people and to make it, you know, she protested vehemently. How could anyone believe in our innate goodness when we've seen how we behaved over the last few years, you know, at the border, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And at first I was sort of, well, I don't know. But then I remembered that there is a dark side that our, and you point this out, that our goodness may only go so far, and then it's about the other and it can devolve into tribalism. Is that a lot of what's going on that brings about her protest?
Well, I think your sister is absolutely right. In a way, this book is not only about why we are the friendliest species in the animal kingdom, it's also about why we are probably the cruelest species in the animal kingdom. We are the only ones who, you know, who commit genocides, for example, or ethnic cleansing, or things like Auschwitz or the Holocaust. Like, I couldn't imagine pandas doing something like that, or chimpanzees, or whatever. So this is obviously the big question that hangs over my book is how do you explain that? Now, one of the most important things I try to get across is that the idea that our civilization is just a thin veneer, just a thin layer, and that below that lies raw human nature, which is just selfish and nasty and evil, that that isn't right. That really is incorrect. It's called veneer theory, this, I believe, mistaken notion. And it comes back again and again, also after the Second World War, by the way, when again it was invoked by people like William Golding, who wrote Lord of the Flies, but also by famous psychologists such as Philip Zimbardo, who done the infamous Stanford Prison Experiment. Very often people try to explain evil by just saying, look, civilization is just a thin veneer, and below that, people are evil. And that's where it comes from. Now, once you don't buy that anymore, then you have to come up with a different explanation. And I think a much more nuanced, much more complex, much more layered explanation of evil. One of the things you'll have to recognize is that very often people can do the most horrible things in the name of the good.
Yes.
While they're believing they believe they're on the good side of history. So I've got one chapter in the book, for example, about German soldiers during the Second World War, especially in 1944 and 1945. Now, the German army was the most effective fighting machine the world had ever seen. You know, much more effective than the Allied armies. Historians later calculated that on average they were 50% more effective, you know, in just in terms of the amount of casualties they caused on the other side. And even in 1944, 1945, after D-Day, when the Russians were coming from the east, even then they were still fighting like fanatics, very hard, very effectively. And the Allied command just couldn't understand it. You know, what was going on? Why were these soldiers not giving up when it was clear they were going to lose the war? So what they started to do is to interview prisoners of war. And what they expected, what most psychologists expected around the time, is that probably these soldiers were just brainwashed, right? Completely brainwashed by Nazi ideology. And this could be the only thing that could explain why they were fighting so hard. But then they started doing these interviews, and it started to dawn on them that, in fact, it was not ideology, or ideology was not the most important reason why they were fighting very hard. What was much, much more important was Kameradschaft in German, or comradeship. These soldiers were fighting for their friends. They didn't want to let their friends down, their brothers in arms down. And the German army command understood this. They were very much aware of this. And that's why try very hard not to separate these bands of brothers, right? And to keep them together for as long as possible when they were planning all their military efforts and deployed the troops. Now, obviously, this doesn't, I mean, it doesn't make me comfortable, right? It doesn't condone anything. It's just an explanation that history is not like in the Hollywood movies, like that the good people know they're good and the evil people know they're bad.
Yes.
That's not how it is. Usually, both sides think they're really on the right side of history. So that's obviously one uncomfortable fact you have to reckon with. Now, I'm not saying this explains everything, right? This explanation doesn't work for SS commanders, right? Who were probably ideological fanatics. And by the way, also very often believed they were doing good.
Yep.
But then that explanation doesn't work for just sadistic camp guards, right? Who just enjoyed this violence and enjoyed torturing other people. Now, I think that latter phenomenon is really rare. So the Joker, right? The people who just want to watch the world burn and just enjoy that, they exist, right? There are psychopaths in this world who really enjoy torturing other people. It's just that they're very, very rare. And for most people, being violent is difficult, right? It goes against our own human nature.
Well, there's so much that I learned in your book, but one of them is that the most reliable research on soldiers at war is that very few of them ever fire their weapons.
Yeah. Yeah. It's astonishing. It's really astonishing. And it's crazy that they don't teach this in school, because I don't know, it seems to be quite a fundamental fact. But indeed, it was discovered in the Second World War by an American historian who was embedded within the military. His name was S.L.A. Marshall. And he had the unique opportunity to interview troops after battle. He developed these group interviews as a form. So immediately after battle, he brought them together and he started asking them questions, and the soldiers were free to say whatever happened and also, you know, contradict their superiors, etc. He really took a lot of effort to give them the freedom to say what they wanted. And he was one of the first who really discovered that most of these soldiers didn't really fire their guns during battle. Most didn't do it and came up with all kinds of excuses, you know, get a coffee for someone else, I don't know, ammunition or take cover or whatever. His estimate, and I should say this was an estimate, right? It was a guess. His estimate that was only around 15 to 25% of soldiers actually fired their guns. Now, there's been a long debate about this theory, this idea, and some people have cast doubt on SLA Marshall's methods. Some people have even said that he was a fraud himself, right? That it was unreliable. Mm-hmm. Now, in the book, I try to show that indeed he was a bit of a problematic man, you know, mm-hmm. a bit of as a writer, a little bit flashy and sometimes mm-hmm. not really careful with the evidence. But the theory itself is sound, and ever since, more and more evidence has been collected. And today, actually, in military academies in the US and around the globe, SLA Marshall is required reading. The American army understood very, very well that this was actually a huge problem.
Yes.
That if you just draft a soldier, and you draft the soldier, you know, you give 6 weeks of training, send him into battle, it's going to be an extraordinarily ineffective soldier, right? It's not going to be able to pull the trigger most of the time. Because in most human beings, there's this natural, inhibition that we just can't do it. It's really hard for most of us. Now, there are ways to overcome it, right? You can brainwash, you can condition people, and the American military has developed highly effective ways of doing that. And so what we see, for example, already during the Vietnam War, is that many more soldiers are able to pull the trigger.
Mm.
It's just that they pay a price for it. So we all know that so many of these soldiers came back from Vietnam with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And one of the main reasons was that they had killed. I think this is, we've got a lot of convincing evidence here that soldiers who've actually killed enemy combatants have a much, much higher chance of developing PTSD, which seems suggestive to me, right? If we are really killer apes,
yes,
know, then why would we be traumatized by killing someone else, right? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
It does make sense if you buy into the theory of survival of the friendliest. Then it,
that's right.
Then it makes perfect sense, right? That there was no evolutionary advantage for us to enjoy killing. The opposite, in fact.
And so it seems to me, sort of what I said in the setup to that question was that the allegiance, the caring, the compassion for those close to us, as we found out, that's the German army. And I think it's every army. Everything that I've read about soldiers is that they are fighting for their buddies much more than they're fighting for their flag. But as I called it, the dark side of that is that beyond a certain point, someone is no longer your family, your parish, your tribe. They're the other. And your very deep feelings for your own can be translated and manipulated into dark feelings for the other. And you add that to the thing that you said, which is that very often people do what look to others as negative behavior, but they do it thinking they're doing the good. And I would say that what we see in America right now in the, you know, the split of the political split is that, as crazy as it is, those people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th say they're the patriots, right? Mm-hmm. And they're preserving the Constitution and they're preserving the ideals of the country in doing something which someone else standing outside of their group says, no, you are exactly what you're fighting against.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's very important to understand. So what I saw a lot, for example, in the debate around masks, I saw a lot of liberals saying, how could you be so selfish, right? That you don't even want to wear a mask, right? You don't even want to take this little effort to protect people around you. People who don't wear masks must be incredibly selfish. And I think that's really a misunderstanding of what's going on there. Very quickly, wearing masks, especially in the US, became, you know, sort of the symbol of being liberal, of being a Democrat. And so, of course, as a conservative or a Republican, you were less likely to wear a mask because you're loyal to your own group, right? Yeah. You don't want to look like the other group. So, I mean, there have been dozens and dozens of books about polarization and about this problem of tribal behavior. Maybe it's not all that valuable to, again, go over all the evidence because there's so many books about it. What I try to do in my book is to show that there are ways to overcome it.
Yes.
And maybe we should talk about them more.
Yes. And I'm just going to, before we do, let me just set up just for a second. And we have about 5 minutes. But I wanted to tell people that in the course of this book, Rutger will take on Easter Island, what really happened there. He'll take on the Stanford Prison Experiment, Milgram's Shock Experiment, the Pygmalion Effect, the Commons, Richard Dawkins' Selfish Gene, et cetera, an awful lot of things that might pop into your head as being on one side or the other of this argument he will deal with. But for right now, let's move to this. And I want to set it up by you in some other writing that I've seen you do, you have talked about the fact that this is a moment when change is possible. I think you even quote the Financial Times or something as saying it's pretty clear that 30 years from now, things will be considered common sense that are seen as bizarre nowadays. Mm-hmm. And the question really is, if this is one of those moments, because of the pandemic, perhaps, because of whatever else is going on right now, if this is a moment when things can change, how do we move them in this direction? Mm-hmm.
You know, what I love about history and what I love about being a historian is that history just shows you that things can be different. There's nothing inevitable about the way we've structured our society and economy right now. You know, last time we spoke about my previous book, Utopia for Realists, I probably still told this story about how in the 1970s, Richard Nixon, of all people, almost implemented
yes.
a basic income in the United States, right? He almost, like, pretty much abolished poverty in the United States. And yeah, for many people, that's a huge surprise. But it just shows you that if you zoom out a little bit, so much more is possible than we think. And so for the last 40 years, we lived in an era that is often described as the neoliberal era. Yep. Right? Neoliberalism is this ideology that originated in the 1950s and really took hold in the 1970s and the 1980s. And was all about privatization, of getting the government out of the way, of growing inequality, etc., which was supposed to be good for everyone. And it's been an incredibly dominant and influential ideology around the globe, also in Europe and in many other parts of the globe. And what I think we can say now is that the pandemic has killed neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. And the question is, what's next? You know, what's going to replace it? And there are very exciting new ideas out there, I'd say. If I look at the new generation of economists, for mm-hmm. example, it's completely different from what we've had. So there are obviously the French economists, right? Thomas Piketty with his book Capital. There's a lot of new thinking about inequality there. But maybe even more exciting is this new generation of female economists,
yes.
such as the Italian economist Mariana Mazzucato or Stephanie Kelton, she's an American, who are rethinking who the real wealth creators are in this society. Where does wealth come from? You know, for such a long time, we've heard this story that wealth is created by, you know, these great entrepreneurs at the top who come up with all these wonderful innovations and blah, blah, blah. And we should be very grateful for them. And, we shouldn't tax them too much because that will make sure we'll have less innovation. You know, this is the standard story that we've always been told. Now, what the pandemic has done, I guess, is that it has made us realize that there are so many people doing what we now call vital jobs, right? Vital
yes,
workers or essential
workers. Yes.
Yeah. And we really need them. If they go on strike, we're in trouble, right? And the economy crashes. But then why don't we even pay them a living wage, right? And we've also realized that a lot of the really fundamental innovation, for example, these vaccines.
Yes.
Yes, they're distributed by Pfizer and AstraZeneca, etc., and they've done some important work. But if you look at the fundamental technologies behind it, so RNA technology, for example, it's been developed by researchers on the government payroll with your tax money, right? So is it then fair that private companies are making a killing, right, and making so much money on it? Probably not. So I'm really excited about this new generation of economists that is sort of helping us rethink where wealth comes from. And it's a very, very different story than the story we've heard for the last 40 years.
Right. And I'm going to make sort of the last point and then bring this to a close. But it's your last, it's a point you make as well, which mm-hmm. is that Milton Friedman famously said, no crisis should go to waste. What we saw was that a failure of the progressives or the left has often been that it was clearer what they were against than what they mm-hmm. were for. In this latest crisis, the pandemic, and in the ongoing crisis of climate change, this time around, it does look like people like the economists you're talking about and others have ideas, and that the possibility of rooting them in this sense of human nature and the possibility that opens up for us is a hopeful direction forward.
Absolutely.
The book is Humankind. The website is rutgerbregman.com, RutgerBregman, rutgerbregman.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, to the same website. If you want to get my weekly announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and links to 10 to 15 articles to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site, terrencemcnally.net, or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, most major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at my site or at Apple Podcasts. I mean years. We're going back, I think the podcasts go back almost 20. And you can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos of Progressive Voices. And most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Finally, thank you, Rutger Bregman. Keep up the good work.
Thanks. Really enjoyed it.